I was probably 8 or 9 years old when I finally made the decision about what I was going to do with the rest of my life. I know a lot of people wait until long after they're 8 or 9 years old to decide what they were going to do with their life. But I was convinced. I was hooked. At 9 years old, I was going to be a roller coaster designer.
The World Beyond. Michael Mack and his Emotioneers of Tomorrow. The Mack One Podcast.
Hi, everybody. Michael Mack here, the founder and CEO of Mack One. Welcome to the World Beyond. Our team at Mack One creates innovative theme park designs and media-based entertainment. We are the Emotioneers of Tomorrow. In this episode, my colleague Lukas Metzger will explore what the future of tomorrow holds. Let's dive right in.
Today, our guest is Jeff Pike. He is co-founder of Skyline Attractions, a company that specializes in the development and construction of theme park attractions. Jeff, perfect that you are here back at Europa Park. It's a pleasure for me to speak to you today.
Thank you, Lucas. I love this park. I love everything about this park. And when we were planning my vacation this year, my son and my wife were asking, where should we take my son's girlfriend for a nice vacation? And I said, I know a nice place over in Germany. We can spend a couple days there. I think that'll really impress her. So far, it's working, I think. Yeah.
When was the last time that you've been here?
Well, I never get to come here and play.
Okay.
I always come here and work, right? And so I was here actually for work a few months ago. We were looking at some technical things on Wodan. So I wanted to have some time to come and actually play and enjoy the rest of the park.
So I just mentioned you're the co-founder of Skyline Attractions, and the company is known for innovative and exciting rides that often incorporates also new concepts of technologies. And our podcast here is totally based about, you know, new trends of our industry. And speaking about the industry, you have a pretty long career in the industry. And before founding Skyline Attractions, you've been working for many other companies, including Great Coast International, GCI, who is every guest of Europa Park has seen a product of GCI.
Of course.
Wodan, our wooden roller coaster here in the park. And I was very excited when this coaster was announced because I was in the peak moments of being a theme park nerd. So before
you're a theme park nerd.
I was a completely theme park nerd. So before
now
diving,
it all makes sense.
So before diving in this industry as professional, I was a super nerd, and I was like, you know, it was the internet was there, but it wasn't like that you would live stream an announcement or so.
Sure.
So I think at some point just a model just showed up in the middle of the park, you know, with an announcement in the background. And I was super, super excited about that.
So my business partner, Chris Gray, built that model.
I know.
You know,
Chris.
I know Chris. And that was a spectacular model. And he hit all these cute little little scenes in the model. If you spent hours looking at it, you'd find all sorts of neat little Easter eggs.
I was super, super happy about that announcement. But I think we're going to talk about Wodan, our wooden coaster here at Europa Park, in a few moments.
All right.
Usually, before we dive deeper into a topic, I have short questions with maybe short answers of you.
I didn't study. I didn't study. I don't know any answers to any questions that are. I didn't study.
No, it's all about, you know, it's.
One.
What is your favorite ride of all time? At all time?
Oh, come on.
Your most favorite, of course.
Yeah, that's like asking a parent who their favorite kid is. Come on.
I know. Okay. So let's say, what's your favorite theme park attraction that you've been not been involved with?
Until yesterday, I probably would have given a different answer.
Okay.
But yesterday, I had the opportunity to spend a little bit of time with Christian Everfelt and Michael Mack here at the park. I just wanted to make sure I said hi while I was here. And they brought me on a little new roller coaster called Voltron here at Europa Park.
Yeah, a little coaster.
Just a little coaster. No, I mean, that now, I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass here, right? That now is my favorite theme park attraction.
Wow, thank you very much.
It really is. I mean, it up until then, it was probably the Velocicoaster in Orlando.
Yeah.
Don't tell the guys at the Intamin I said that. But Velocicoaster was a full package, and I think that it takes a lot of planning and a lot of effort and a lot of time to really pull off a roller coaster that is not just a piece of hardware, right?
Yeah.
Something that's an experience requires planning far beyond the design of a roller coaster track, which is, you know, what I know. That's my specialty. So you put this project in the hands of really talented, creative people like the folks here at Europa Park, and you end up with Voltron. I mean, it is every bit a complete package ride. It really is. It is a high thrill, smooth. It's immersive when you walk through that queue with mm-hmm. the Tesla coils above you yeah. and the noise and the music. I mean, everything just came together perfectly. Wow. And you might think that I'm just saying this because I'm sitting across from you and because I'm on Michael okay. Mack's podcast.
And tomorrow you're going to another German theme park now? Or
no, tomorrow I'm coming back here in the morning and then we're headed to Munich for a little bit. But no, I mean, this is now my new favorite theme park ride here.
Thank you very much. It's so nice to hear. So I think you're more roller coaster person than a dark ride person.
Yeah, I would say that. Although I have to spend a lot of time on dark rides because if I convince my wife to come to parks with me, she likes the dark rides. Yep. So we've already today been on like six dark rides.
Okay, so it has to be good balance always.
It has to be a good balance, yes.
Ooh, okay. Two. Next question. What is the first thing you do in the morning?
Oh, geez. It's coffee. It's always
same
coffee.
For me.
You know, you get up and my kids get up and go to school very, very early in the morning. They leave at about 6:30 in the morning. And so right after they leave, I like to sit on my porch and drink 1, 2, 3, 7 cups of coffee. And then that kind of gets me going enough to get into my office. My primary office is in my house, which is nice. And so I can just lock myself in the office and dive into it there at work. But it's coffee. Gotta have it.
Three. What is your favorite hobby?
That's a really interesting question, and I think a lot of people would assume is roller coasters, right? And when I was a kid, roller coasters absolutely were my favorite hobby. I grew up in Cincinnati going to Kings Island, which is a very large, you know, I don't know how many of your listeners are in the U.S., but a lot of the U.S. people and coaster yogis, we call them coaster nuts, they know of Kings Island because it has some legendary roller coasters such as the Beast.
Yeah.
It had one of the largest Aero multi-looping coasters, the Vortex. So I grew up there and everybody, you know, that was my passion as a kid growing up was roller coasters. But today, interestingly enough, my hobby has actually moved a little bit laterally into other parts of themed entertainment. And I'm very into pyrotechnics.
Mm-hmm.
For a while, I had a professional display license in the United States and helped produce professional fireworks shows in California and Indiana and in Ohio. And now I got out of the, you know, I dabbled in the professional part of it, but I think the more fun part of it is keeping it a hobby.
Mm-hmm.
They say, keep your hobbies and your profession separate.
Yeah.
I didn't take that advice with my first hobby, and I made roller coasters my profession, which has had some highs and it's had some lows. So I've kept my hobby of pyrotechnics pretty, you know, pretty separate. I don't try to make money with it. I just have fun with a lot of other guys that understand the art of pyrotechnics, building fireworks, not just producing shows with, you know.
Are you also building your own?
Oh, yes. We build fireworks.
Okay.
One of my, so when I do work calls and everything, my image for my contact, you know, people upload a picture of themselves looking good or whatever, you know, some selfie with it. Make a duck lips. I did a picture of a partially built 6-inch diameter, 3-petal firework that I was building.
Yeah.
And nobody knows what that looks like unless you're in the pyrotechnics industry. So I always get questions. Is that a cupcake in your picture? Why do you have a cupcake in your picture?
I think you would really have a good topic to discuss with Patrick. Patrick Marx. I don't know if you know him. He's the project manager of Voltron.
Okay.
Also a mechanical engineer. He's also quite a hobbyer about pyrotechnics, so...
Awesome, yeah. It is. It's a lot of fun learning the chemistry and the physics behind all of it. Yeah. It's quite a thing.
Cool. Four. Do you have a childhood hero? And if yes, who is it?
That is a great question. And yes, and it will never change. My childhood hero, and a lot of people say this, but for me, it's absolutely true, was my father. My father was always pushing me to do what I thought was going to be best for me. He was a very pragmatic person. He was an engineer as well. You know, I went to engineering school. My father was an engineer. He was very logical.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he saw in me something a little bit different from him on the creative side. He spent his time working in chemistry for soaps and surfactants and Procter & Gamble, making Tide laundry detergent. And I think he was excited that I was both technical, but also I had sort of this creative bent, and I really wanted to get into roller coaster design. And my mother, to some extent as well, but my father was really the one who, you know, who recognized that, A, it wasn't going to be easy. B, he gave me good, solid advice. He said, stick with it.
Yeah.
You may not make it, but stick with it.
Yeah.
And C, he was always there to applaud whenever I was able to actually pull off a big new project. My dad made it a point, as much as he could, to ride my roller coasters when he could. Traveled to California with my sons and I and rode my roller coaster out there at Great America. he was always my champion for everything that I did. He passed away this past year, but I will always keep him in my heart, and he was absolutely my hero.
Wow, that's a fantastic story. Thank you very much for sharing. So Jeff, could you give us a brief overview about your career and how you did end up in the theme park industry and founding of Skyline
Attractions?
Well,
how long do you have?
I'm looking at the producer.
I could go days for it. So I told you earlier, I was growing up in Cincinnati, going to Kings Island.
Yeah.
And I remember being there with my father. It was a few years after the Beast opened, and I had finally gotten tall enough to ride the Beast. The ride actually opened the year before I was born.
Yeah.
I was probably 5 or 6 when I was tall enough to ride it. I think at the time, I don't think it was always a 48-inch height. It was a lower height requirement in those olden days. Yeah. And I rode that with my father. I was terrified. If you've never been on a big roller coaster like the Beast at, you know, a 6-year-old, that's a big one to cut your teeth on, you know?
Yeah.
So I rode that and I was terrified, but I was also at the end of it, I was really intrigued by that. And I really started to get into coasters. And I remember asking my dad, Dad, who makes roller coasters? Like, how do you build them? Who makes them? And he said, you know, Jeff, I don't know, but you probably got to have, you know, an engineering knowledge and design knowledge, maybe architecture. And he was not wrong about any of those. So I decided from that point, I was probably 8 or 9 years old when I finally made the decision about what I was going to do with the rest of my life. I know a lot of people wait until long after they're 8 or 9 years old to decide what they were going to do with their life. But I was convinced, I was hooked. At 9 years old, I was going to be a roller coaster designer. And I spent time, this was before the internet, and I spent time trying to find out who the other roller coaster designers actually were. And to do that, you had to go to the library. And you go to the library and you look up magazine articles from Popular Mechanics in 1982 and things like that, right? And I started seeing these names that were repeating, Aerodynamics.
Yeah.
Charlie Dinn, the Dinn Corporation, Curtis Summers, Anton Schwarzkopf, right? I started seeing these names in these magazines and said, I gotta get a hold of these people. Now, it's hard enough today. Okay. Like, if I wanted to get a hold today of, you know, of some roller coaster designer, there's you can get on the internet, you can, you know, go to the Contact Us page and you click, you know. It wasn't like that when I was a kid, right? So I had to dig even deeper. And I started writing these handwritten letters to the new parks that would announce new coasters every year. And I'd write 15 or 20 every month and send out these mass mailings to Six Flags Over Texas, to Worlds of Fun, to Michigan's Adventure, to Kings Island. And I would just send all these letters saying, hey, I really want to make roller coasters. Who designed your roller coaster and how can I write a letter to this person? And I would get responses. I mean, it was amazing. See these, and I think people that ran amusement parks, and even today, like looking at the Mack family, Michael Mack may not admit it, but he's a coaster yogi.
Yeah,
he loves roller coasters, right?
Yeah.
And so I think they were excited to hear from somebody like me, you know. And
how old were you back then?
I was probably maybe nine or 10 years
nine
old.
9 or 10 years, wow.
And I would get answers. Yeah. I would wait. I'd check the mailbox every day, and I would get answers. And I finally got this package of information from Six Flags Over Texas the year the Texas Giant opened.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I was reading through, you know, that in the media, the parks will give these fact sheets to the media that have, you know, height, length, who designed it, whatever. And at the bottom of this fact sheet listed ride manufacturer, the Dinn Corporation, Cincinnati, Ohio, designer Curtis Summers from the Curtis D. Summers Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And I about fell out of my chair. I lived in Cincinnati, Ohio, and these guys designed and built the Texas Giant, and they're in Cincinnati? Oh, I've got to find them.
Uh-huh.
And so how do you find somebody in a city if you know the name of their company? Well, for your younger readers, we used to have a big book. And this book you would open up and you'd start looking up. And sure enough, the Curtis Summers Company was listed in the white pages of the Cincinnati phone book.
And then you just drove there.
Well, I called first.
You called first.
So I called first, and I'll never forget her name, Phyllis. And Phyllis was Mr. Summers' secretary at the time. Hi, Phyllis. My name is Jeff. I want to make roller coasters. Can I meet Curtis Summers? I would really like to talk to you.
You were nine.
I was not 10 maybe, but 9 or 10. And I can just imagine her face on the other side, like, what in the world is going on?
Yeah.
So, you know, she was polite at first and kind of said, oh, I'll give him the message. Uh-huh. Thank you. And I didn't hear from him for a week, I called back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think I probably called 4 times over the course of the next month. And Phyllis finally, either out of exasperation or because she genuinely wanted to help me, and I think she did.
Yeah.
She said, Jeff, I'm going to let you talk to Mr. Summers right now. Hold on a second. So she put him on the phone, and he invited me to his office to spend the day with him at his office. You have no idea how excited I was.
Yeah.
My mother drove me to Macy's to buy a new suit, and I got myself a suit and a red tie, and we drove to Curtis Summers' office in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I spent the day with him, and it was like, I mean, imagine if you want to get into the movies and getting a call from Brad Pitt saying, why don't you come and spend a day with me making a movie, right?
Yeah.
Oh, it was so fantastic.
Yeah.
And he gave me advice very similar to what my dad said, you know, and I'll never forget what he told me. He said, you know, Jeff, there have been more United States presidents than there have been real honest to God roller coaster designers.
Yes.
So the odds aren't great, but stick with it. If this is really what you want to do, make sure that you build up a good background of knowledge on the technical side, on the engineering side. So if it doesn't happen, you still have something to fall back on, right? And I did. He said, you don't have to go to a big name school. You can go to any school that teaches the good fundamentals, and you need to learn how to make amusement park rides and roller coasters from people that already do it. So you need to continue this strategy that you've so eloquently employed by tracking me down, and continue to do that throughout your student career and in your early professional career, and maybe you'll get a break. And if you do, be ready to pounce on that. So, you know, people say that you got to make your own luck. You know, there's no such thing as just dumb luck, but if something happens and you've made your own luck and you put yourself in the best position to pounce, then I think that that's doing yourself the biggest favor that you can from a career standpoint.
Wow.
So through college, I told you this was a long story. Didn't I?
I'm very happy to hear that story, because it's so important, especially, you know, for our younger listeners, because, you know, it's all about passion and motivation and, you know, about the aim and the really wish to do something.
Yeah.
And that's so much more important than, of course, you need to be smart, you need to learn, you need to study. But at least in my opinion, passion and the heart at the right place is more important than grades in school, for example. So
you got to get good grades, but yes, the passion may be more important than that, because when things don't go well, if you get good grades, that's great. But if you don't have the passion, you get easily discouraged and you can get, you know, you can move on to something else.
Yeah.
So in college, when I was going through my college career, I was a something of an unusual engineering student. You know, they say engineering students tend to be the dull ones, you know, that are, well, so my career at the University of Louisville in Louisville, Kentucky, was about 50% of the time studying for my engineering classes. 25% of the time I was the mascot for the sports teams. I wasn't good enough to play sports, but that was, I think, my outlet for getting some energy out and getting out of the study room a little bit. And the other 25% of the time was spent writing letters, and, you know, the internet had finally become a thing back then, and I started to figure out how to email and send messages electronically to some of these folks. So I spent very little of my college career dating or on things like that, which my friends all thought was something strange, but they, you know, they allowed it. And so during college, I actually ended up interviewing. I went to IAPA, the International Association of Amuse Parks and Attractions. Every year they have several conferences around the world, and they host a conference in the United States every year. At the time, it rotated around different cities. I think now it stays more or less in Orlando. But they had a conference in, it was New Orleans. And I had convinced my father, I was still probably a sophomore in university, and I convinced my father to go with me to the IAPA conference in New Orleans. And I just walked around the floor introducing myself to people like so many people do now. I mean, if you attend the IAPA show now, that's the exact same, and it's a good strategy. You get to, you get your face in front of folks. And it was there that I met several people. I met Mike Boodley and Claire Hain, who had just founded a brand new company specializing in wooden roller coaster design and construction called Great Coasters International.
Well, I've heard that name before.
I also met Dana Morgan and Steve Okamoto from the Morgan Manufacturing Company. And at the time, I had met Dick Chance and Gordon Baker, who were with Chance Rides.
Yeah.
And all of them had some, you know, they spent time talking to me. They were all very, you know, gracious, you know. And I ended up getting an offer to do an internship with Chance Rides. I did not get an offer from either Great Coasters or from Morgan Manufacturing initially, but I did get an offer from Chance Rides. And I took that offer. And a week before I was scheduled to go to Wichita, Kansas to start working on amusement park rides, which is what I always wanted to do, I was so excited. I went on a vacation with my family on a ski trip, and I fractured my L1 vertebrae in a skiing accident.
Oh, no.
And that put me... That put me behind.
So you had to cancel that internship.
I had to cancel the internship. And it was devastating to me. And at the time, I think I got very depressed. I had to go back and re-enroll at school and take some classes. I ended up working for a company that makes printers as a sort of a separate job when I went through that semester of school. It was not the greatest, but like you had mentioned, if you have some passion for it, if it's true passion, it's not going to get wiped out by, you know, a single skiing accident.
No.
And for what it's worth, I've never been skiing again. I won't even get on my... so that was... I think that was somebody trying to teach me some kind of lesson there. Yeah. I actually reached out to Dana Morgan after that, and I said, hi, Dana, I know that I talked to you, and you had expressed interest in doing an internship program.
Yep.
I was going to take this position with Dick Chance. Unfortunately, I had this accident. Do you think there's any way that I could maybe do my second internship with Morgan Manufacturing? And Dana, he found a way to do it. He's like, look, we can work something out, Jeff. If you really want to do that and you're that dedicated, come out to California for your next internship. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of the redirection that I think set me on the sort of the final path of my career here. Had that accident skiing not have happened and I had gone to work for Chance, who knows? Maybe I would not be in the same position I am today. But through my work at Morgan Manufacturing, with Dana and his designer, Steve Okamoto, who I worked very closely with, I think much to Steve's chagrin sometimes. Steve is a very quiet, reserved, professional, technical, or, you know, focused person. It's not that I'm not professional or technical or focused, but I'm maybe not as quiet and maybe not as introverted as some of the people that he was maybe used to working with. So I think I really bothered him, but I bothered him so much that he said, you know what? Instead of talking to me so much at work, why don't you just come to dinner with me and my friend Mike Booley down at the boardwalk, and we'll have dinner down there. And then you can talk to me all you want about roller coasters. While we're here at work, will you shut up, please? You know? So, oh, great. I'll go have Mike Booley. Wait, he's the guy that does wooden roller coasters, right? Yeah, that's right. Those guys were close friends. And so I had dinner with him and Mike Booley. We had lobster out at the Santa Cruz boardwalk. And Mike Booley, he's looking at me. He's like, you really want to make roller coasters, kid? And I'm like, yeah, I do. This is, you know, this is so cool. And I didn't know it at the time, but I really feel like Mike was feeling me out from a personality and a knowledge and an intelligence standpoint. You know, is this kid really, is this guy bonkers, or does he have a head on his shoulders? And through that meeting then with Mike, I had gotten a little bit closer with Mike. And Mike, at some point as a senior in school, he said, hey, Jeff, are you still interested in making wooden roller coasters? I said, are you fucking kidding me? Of course I'm still interested in making wooden roller coasters. That's the beast started it for me. Go back to Kings Island. That was the, you know, Curtis Summers. So he said, okay, well, I need you to start like in a month. And I said, well, I've still got like 1.5 semesters left of school before I get my certificate, my degree. And he had made some suggestions about how to, you know, why don't you try to work that out with your school? You know, see if you can come out. And I said, all right. So I went to my the chair of the mechanical engineering department at the time at University of Louisville. And he wasn't real receptive to me leaving school early, but still completing my degree at U of L. He was going to have me jump through a bunch of hoops out at University of California and everything. I said, man, that can't be right. Mike said, I called Mike. I said, Mike, I'm having a hard time with figuring out a way to complete my degree here. He said, Jeff, go over this guy's head. You know, he's not the end all be all. And if this is the reason you know, from 8 years old, through your entire career all the way up to this point in college, if this job that I'm offering you is the reason that you've been doing all this, you need to do it, and you just need to figure out a way to make it happen, right? And so I said, you know what, you're right. And he had encouraged me to do that, and I went and I talked to the dean of the engineering school, who allowed me to make some accommodations to complete my degree at the University of Louisville via fax machine. I don't know if any of your listeners are familiar with fax machines. People used to communicate back and forth.
I heard that before.
So I took two courses over fax machine from Santa Cruz while I got my feet wet working on wooden roller coasters. And from there, you know, Booley taught me what he could about designing ride center lines, you know, looking all the way back to the advice that Curtis Summers gave me. You know, you're going to have to learn this from somebody that knows how to do it.
Yeah.
And Mike spent the time teaching me, which was it's difficult to do in an environment that moves as fast as ours. Yeah. You know, it's, they're all small companies. You know, people, I think, have this image of a company that builds roller coasters as this big corporate conglomerate or whatever. No. And maybe there's... Maybe also, there's a couple companies.
And also, you know, back in the days where you didn't have the computers to make like a rendering, like an animation. Right. No, it was pure mathematics.
Well, I'm guessing by the structure of this podcast that you might ask about that process here on a later question. Yeah. And I do. I really like to talk to you about how that has changed. And it really has. It's a very different process now, designing rides. So, you know, looking back, getting into this business, I had, some twists and turns. I relied on support and good advice from my parents, my father, my mentors. Curtis Summers was, you know, Michael Boodley. These guys were all instrumental in that. Dana Morgan was super helpful with that. And then the time that I spent at Great Coasters working with Claire when Michael retired, and it was just Claire and I working on coasters, we had ups and downs there, too. You know, right after Michael retired, we had just finished a Lightning Racer project at Hershey Park. And the company had really gotten to the point where it was Claire had bought out Michael and was now 100% owner of Great Coasters. And he asked me if I'd be willing to stick around with the company and come out to Pennsylvania. And I said, sure. The first few months, I worked out of a temporary office space in his daughter's playroom. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was a small operation then. And Claire, to his credit, the guy never stops working. And, you know, he was able to push his product beyond where it had been limited to in the United States and really, you know, was instrumental in pushing over Europe. And so I remember well a lot of the initial meetings and discussions we had with the Mack company and the Mack family when we would fly here to Germany. And yeah, it's just grown. I mean, Asia, Germany, you know, all the rest of Europe, you know, we're all over North America. We have some small projects in South America, and it's just really been quite a thing. And, you know, rolling it all the way back to when I was a kid, when Mr. Summers passed away, I was, I think, a junior in high school. And by that point, Phyllis, the secretary that I would bother so much as a young kid, had gotten to know me so well. And I had spoken with Mr. Summer several times after that, too. After he passed away, his wife asked Phyllis to contact me because she wanted me to have his desk that he worked on. And that, to this day, is the desk that I use when I'm working on amusement park rides. The old Curtis Summers desk, which... designs such as the Texas Giant, the Darien Lake Predator, Thunder Run, those types of things passed across. So maybe someday, I don't know, there'll be some other coaster designer, maybe one of your listeners that's listening right now.
Yeah,
you know,
so, and
maybe they'll end up with the desk, like the Resolute desk of the roller coaster industry.
Wow. So when we think about your work, what you've been done, of course, the best example, because we're just sitting around 800 meters away from it, is like our Wodan wooden coaster. Can you tell us a bit more about the project itself? How did it first start?
Well, it started when Claire and I were making some very clumsy overtures to the European market. We got on a plane. We sort of had a plan, and our plan was... we're going to convince the Europeans that wooden roller coasters can be just as good an investment as steel roller coasters. You know, a lot of your listeners might not know this. 20 years ago, people weren't really building wooden coasters across Europe. I mean, there was one here or there. Blackpool had a few, you know, older ones that they had worked with up in the UK. But it really wasn't an attraction that was at the front of the minds of the people that were investing in theme parks in Europe. And Claire and I saw an opportunity to expand the Great Coasters product line. Spent a lot of time building up a good reputation with some of the projects that we did in the U.S. And so we said, we'll get on a plane, we'll bring some photos, and we'll bring some numbers about maintenance that parks have been willing to share with us, because that was a big objection for a long time, as wooden coasters take.
We always thought maintenance is going to be super expensive.
Sure. And you know, they're a labor of love in some cases. But we wanted to combat that, and I remember just kind of sitting and going through this, you know, early PowerPoint presentation with folks like Court McEvan and Michael and Roland were sitting in on those meetings, and we were just convinced. Well, it just made so much sense, you know, and why don't people see this with wooden coasters? And I think that finally, once we got to Europe, fell by the name of Jorma Lilbacka, who runs a park in Finland called Power Park. Just took it upon himself. He says, all right, I've retired from my big business and I'm going to build a wooden roller coaster. And he did. He took that leap. And I think that the Mack family was watching that project and how it progressed and whether that was a success or a failure for Yorma. Mm-hmm. And it was a really big success at Power Park. And I think that, you know, the Mack family probably said, all right, well, let's ask him again. And I remember having dinners, you know, I think Roland was there, Jorgen was in there, and, you know, we're talking about, you know, the same things that we did a couple years before that. And I have a feeling, although I don't know this, and you should probably ask Michael this if it's true, but I have a feeling that Michael was really the sort of the impetus to saying, hey, let's try this. I think we can make it work. Yes, there's going to be some investment in maintenance. Hopefully it won't be as much as what we're all thinking it will be. You know, I think that Michael convinced the family to sort of take that leap. And we did. And some of the hours that we spent working on the layout for that, right? It was a challenging layout. Europa Park, as you know, in Roost, is very close to a lot of homes, you know, private residences.
City of Roost, also our hotels. Yeah.
Right. And so noise is a big factor. And if you're familiar with wooden roller coasters, you know, they're not generally a quiet attraction, right? They're not, they don't whisper around the track. Yeah. And so we had to spend quite a bit of time arranging the ride in the park in a way that allowed the elevations of the ride to be within a certain distance set back from the edges of the park to help lower the amount of noise that might make it outside of the park. And we've done a lot since then, too, building walls and things like that. But some of the most fun that I had was working with Freddie Pastuzik, who was with the creative side of Europa Park at the time, was responsible for helping to integrate the ride into the site and into the park, which meant that he had to be very close to the layout and understand the layout.
Yeah.
And we did an initial layout that was okay, and I think Michael, he's like, okay, this is all right, but can't you do this, this, and this? And, you know, and that means wholesale changes and a completely new design, you know. But, of course, I'd say, all right, we'll make this right. And Michael said, well, can you have the revised layout ready for us by tomorrow for a presentation at, like, 10 o'clock in the morning? And at this point, it was, like, 4 o'clock in the afternoon the day before.
And you said, no problem at all.
That's exactly what I said. Now, in my head, I'm thinking, oh, gosh, this is a problem. But but Freddie offered. He said, hey, I'll help you. Let's go up to my office here, and you and I can work this out. And so we went up to Freddie's office probably about 6 o'clock and just started with a blank sheet of paper.
Yeah.
Literally, you know, if your listeners are wondering what it's like to design a roller coaster, that early process is literally a piece of paper and a pencil, right? And just kind of sketching, might this look good this way, this way. And Freddie and I at one point got into an argument. It was a little later. It was probably 8:30 or 9 o'clock at night. We got into an argument. I wanted the coaster to do a certain turn. It was near where the Blue Fire coaster was a big curve. And I wanted it to do one thing.
Yeah.
And Freddie wanted it to do something else.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was like, I don't think that's right. He says, well, and he was making a convincing argument, but I still liked my idea better. And he said, you know what, Jeff, we're not getting this done right now. We're butting heads too much. Let's take a break. I said, okay. And he goes, we're going to go bowling. So we're going to do what?
So we went bowling on that evening.
We went bowling that evening.
Uh-huh.
So we took a break. We drove up the road somewhere up here outside of Roost. There's a bowling alley.
Yeah.
And we went bowling. And Freddie said, look, the reason I took you bowling is because I'm a good bowler. And I'm going to bet you that I will beat you in at least one of these two games that we're going to play. And if I do, you have to make that turn do what I wanted it to do. And if you beat me, you can keep the turn the way you want.
Okay, who did win?
It was tight, but I won, and the curve that you see out there now was my idea of the curve. And I was just before this podcast, I was texting Freddie. I'm like, Freddie, I want to make sure that you're okay with me talking about this because, you know, you lost, right? Yeah. And I don't want people thinking you're a loser. Yeah. He's not a loser, but he did lose. I beat him, and I think Blue Fire ended up really cool. I liked the turn, and Freddie actually admitted. He said, yeah, I think it turned out okay. And you still get that pop of airtime after it comes off the turn. He was worried about airtime there because he thought that it didn't look like there was going to be as much airtime on the ride as he wanted. But the way it comes off that flat turn, right when you pass by that Blue Fire curve that's right up against it, and then it dives down again right under the main entryway there.
I think you have so much good airtime on that ride.
Yeah, so it's really well right now, too.
Yeah. Have you been on it recently?
Yeah, today, we're once yesterday, once today. Yeah.
But I really had the feeling it's getting faster each year.
Seems like it, doesn't it? It seems like it.
Yeah.
It's really rocking and rolling right now.
Very cool. So I wanted to ask if there is an element you're particularly proud of on the ride.
But the Blue Fire bowling curve.
Yeah. Which you can. It's a fantastic curve.
We call really it like the bowling curve, yes.
Yeah, I really like that curve. It's a good curve. You know, our theme park industry is also constantly evolving, especially when it comes to technology. How does technology already influence your work, and how do you think it will influence the work in the future?
Oh, that's a great question.
Oh, sorry.
when I was first joining with Great Coasters, Michael Boodley, who I consider to be, you know, one of the most legendary wooden roller coaster designers ever to have lived, was still, in many cases, using pencil and paper when he would do some calculations, which I thought was pretty archaic, using pencil and paper. You know, now he still had a great result at the end of it, but I started using spreadsheets and integrating some software that I had used in school. It was a math software called Maple, which was a math engine that could help do some calculations quicker than what we were doing before. I thought, wow, I've kind of brought it from the pencil and eraser to the spreadsheet era. And now if you say that, oh man, I've brought roller coaster design into the spreadsheet era, these roller coaster designers would look at you and go, almost say, what's a spreadsheet? Mm-hmm. You know? Why are you designing roller coasters in columns and rows with numbers instead of understanding, you know, implicitly the dynamics as you're working on it?
Yeah.
The designers that we employ, I know the designers that Mac employs, and I think all the really good designers now just have such a good understanding of the basis of roller coaster physics. The software is much more specialized for roller coaster dynamic centerline design than it was when I was doing it. I tell you, I look at some of what my own employees work with now. They've written their own software packages to manipulate these roller coaster center lines in three dimensions in real time. I would have never been able to do that. You know, I think that just the ability to unlock the efficiency in track design, at the same time, unlock now, because it's more efficient, you don't have to worry about how much time it's going to take if you need to go back and change something if you don't like it. So now you can try out 75 different iterations instead of four.
Yeah.
And when you can try out 75 different iterations and really tie those down,
we'll find the best.
You get a really good center line. And I think that that has unlocked things like our competitors in the industry, RMC, when they started to really introduce some really kind of far out track designs and dynamic designs. I think everybody took notice of that and said, look, we've kind of moved from a design standpoint past the Texas Giants and the, you know, the Arrow development type center lines. Now we've moved into some really advanced mathematics and advanced technology that allows these center lines. And so if you're going to stay competitive in this industry, you have to do that yourself. And I certainly can tell after riding Voltron yesterday that Mac has embraced that philosophy wholesale. Yeah. I mean, Voltron probably could have existed in the minds of talented designers 20 years ago, but I doubt that they could have made it exist in real life without some of the technology and tools that we have now.
Speaking about not only technology, but also speaking about trends, do you see some specific trends currently influencing our industry?
I do, yeah. And I think one of the biggest trends, at least from a technical... Now, remember, I'm an engineer, right? That's first and foremost, I'm a technical guy. And from a technical standpoint, I think one of the biggest trends is, you know, we're seeing attendances at theme parks globally that are much, much higher than they were before. These rides are subject to intense workouts every day. And people don't quite realize that. You know, you think, well, my car, I only have to do maintenance on my car, you know, once a month or whatever, you know. Roller coasters, amusement rides, they are very, very maintenance intensive. Yep. There's a lot of work. And I think one of the things that has taken a lot of attention recently is welded joints in both structures and in vehicles. And a well-designed weld works well, you know, but if you don't keep up with the inspection and maintenance of that, it tends to be a lot of work to keep welded joints going for a long period of time. So there was this trend to move away from welded joints, both in vehicle construction and in structure. Yeah. And we kind of looked at that and we said, look, structures are moving to non-welded joints. Chassis for vehicles are moving to these fully machined, you know, now technology and the advancement of CNC machining has gotten to the point where you can fully machine a vehicle chassis out of a single piece of metal. Yeah. And we were kind of asking ourselves, what could we do on the track side? Because track still, for the most part, is welded. And so... One of the innovations that we worked on at Skyline, and then we worked very closely with Great Coasters to introduce, was our Titan Track, or our all mechanically fastened riveted track construction technique that allows us to develop and build these three-dimensional track shapes without having to put welds or heat into the track. And so that was a big leap forward. And the Titan Track installations that Claire has put out there with Great Coasters are running very, very well. We are just starting to incorporate that same technology into our attractions at Skyline with our kids' rides. So we've got our eyes very closely on that. We're working very hard on making that a reliable and sort of a hopefully profitable venture for us down the line.
That sounds quite interesting. And also, you know, we just learned you're a mechanical engineer, but at Europa Park, we are very story-based and we're known for theming our immersive experiences. What do you think? How important is the connection between the storytelling and the technology that runs the attraction itself?
I didn't read these questions beforehand, but these are some really good questions. I think I alluded earlier when you asked about what my favorite ride was. A really well put together ride is more than just a piece of hardware, right? Now, if your goal is as an operator, and different parks have different goals, right? Some operators, they're thrill parks, they're amusement parks. They're not necessarily theme parks. That's how they market themselves as amusement parks. And so they're really marketing the hardware side of things. And that's been successful in a lot of cases. There's a lot of, you know, I think Six Flags built a brand on being, you know, the brand with the most thrills.
Yeah.
So that can work, but I think that as part of an entire experience, an entire package, if you're selling and marketing yourself as a theme park, that story is, it's crucial. And understanding the story is crucial. I mean, I am not a creative professional, right? Mm-hmm. But I can grasp how difficult it is to tell a compelling story in a short period of time that integrates well with whatever ride system that you've got. That's a hard task to do. And it seems like it's so easy sometimes when you go through Europa Park and you see something like the story that they tell with Wodan or with Voltron. But I think that it's not so easy. And some of that, I think, is a technical limitation. You know, back in the 1980s and 1990s, the ability to integrate show equipment and show features into ride systems, it was tough. I mean, ride control systems themselves were still, in a lot of cases in the 80s, being run by mechanical relays. The idea of a programmable logic controller to operate a ride safely and efficiently really kind of took off, you know, in the past few decades. But in the 80s, 70s and 80s, integrating a show was nothing more than, well, let's try to find a place to put another mechanical limit switch. And when the car rolls over it, a goblin pops out or something. And maybe that goblin would have been great. It could have been a great goblin. It could have been the best damn goblin that anybody ever made. But it was just a goblin popping out, right? And that's not a story. That's not linking some bigger feature to the hardware of the ride. That's linking really cool goblin to a piece of hardware. So, yeah, I think that I'm shamelessly plugging Voltron here as many times as I can, and I swear the Mac family.
What did Michael say? I think it was 10 euros, right?
Michael, Michael promised you guys, nobody's paying me for this. But I think that the way that that story gets integrated and the ability. Now, look at, I'm not going to, no spoilers for your listeners if you haven't been on Voltron, but go through the queue, through that pre-show area.
Take the time there.
Yeah, and look at the technology that's being used in that pre-show area. If you were a roller coaster nut, if you were a theme park kid from 1992 and you walked through that, I mean, I don't know that you'd be able to come out of that, you know, without your heart exploding. It was just one of the coolest things. So that story with that piece of hardware on that ride is what makes that experience the most premier roller coaster experience in the world right now.
Thank you very much for that feedback. It's highly appreciated. And being so highly also involved in the project of Voltron, very happy to hear your feedback on that.
It's true. It's all true.
But when you look, you just mentioned, you know, the theme park nerd. We're now looking back to the young theme park nerd in the year, what was it, 1992?
Somewhere around there, yeah.
What kind of advice would you give that young theme park nerd,
you know,
to step into the industry?
I'd probably give them, if they're interested in being in the industry, I'd give them the same advice that I received from Curtis Summers, which is stick with it. Yeah. You're going to hear a lot of people tell you, wow, come on, man. Really? You're going to make roller coasters? You're going to make theme park attractions? Come on. How many people really do that? You know, it's actually a much bigger business today than it even was back when I was, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s when I was trying to get into it. And I think there's a lot of opportunities for technical people, for creative people. And I would stick with it. And I think one of the harshest things to read, I think some of the most pointed and the most stinging criticism can come from within our own communities, right? Theme park nerds that are enjoying rides are sometimes, you know, somebody gets online, you know, and says, hey, I want to make theme park rides. And I pay attention to those. Like, I'm on Reddit. I don't know if you've heard of Reddit, but I'm on Reddit. And I read those threads where somebody posts, hey, I want to make roller coasters. And, you know, I'd say the balance is usually, you know, 70% supportive, but there's always like 25, 30% people like, you're never going to be able to do this. Why are you doing this? Try something else, you know? And it's, I don't think that anybody that wants to get in this should be disheartened by that. Stick with it. Study, focus. You're going to have to prove yourself, right? You can't just fake your way through this kind of work. You have to put in the effort and the work to make sure that you understand the source material and that you understand how to execute things. You have to be able to work with people, right? And I think that from my standpoint, I tend to be a fairly social person, and I think that was helpful to me. But you can still work effectively with people regardless of how social or unsocial you are.
Yeah.
And I think you've just got to find that niche and make sure that you can deliver what is expected of you and that you don't lose that passion. Don't lose sight of that, right? Because that's going to be what gets you through the hard times. And believe you me, I mean, I've been doing this since, you know, mid-90s. There's some hard times.
Mm-hmm.
It's not all fun and games. It's not all the exciting, you know, midnight roller coaster bowling design sessions that I have with Freddie. It's one of my greatest memories, but that's not really what the job is. So be prepared to do work and be prepared to enjoy the moments when you can.
Fantastic. That's super, super nice feedback for everyone who is young and wants to dive into our industry as well. So to conclude now, I really would love to hear your thoughts on the future.
7 years from now,
how do you think will the world of amusement parks change in the next 7 years?
You know, if you had asked me that 7 years ago, I would not have predicted, I think, the way that the industry has turned out now. I think that if there's continued investment the way that there is, look at what's going on in Saudi Arabia.
Oh, yeah.
Look at what's going on in China.
Yeah.
You know, if that level of investment still gets into the industry, regardless of the success of the individual projects that are happening out there, that kind of investment is a huge boon to the manufacturers and the creative people that make theme parks happen. Mm. And so I think that the value of that investment goes beyond just making a cool theme park in Saudi Arabia. The value of that investment is that it supports our entire industry by releasing capital and allowing manufacturers to push products and ideas and technology forward. And so if that continues to happen in 7 years, who the heck knows what's going to... I mean, honestly, I would not be surprised to see, you know, magnetic levitation roller coasters or, you know, fireworks that can dance in different directions in the sky.
Yeah.
I think that the sky is literally the limit. I don't know. I mean, maybe space is the limit. Maybe not seven years for space.
Maybe 7 years is a bit too early for space.
Maybe for space, but down the line.
Who knows?
But I don't know. I mean, if that level of investment stagnates, if there's a change in the way that individual park operators or park chain operators invest in rides, it may stymie innovation for a little bit. You know, I don't know. It's very difficult to tell. I just hope that there are still visionaries out there like Franz Mack. I hope there are still visionaries out there like Walt Disney. I hope there are still visionaries out there that can say, look, if we have the money and we have the the capability and we have the team, let's see what we can do. Let's see what we can do.
Jeff, it's been a great pleasure to have you here at our podcast. Thank you very much for this inspiring conversation.
Oh, no, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
And thanks to all the viewers and listeners. And thank you for Michael Mack for bringing us together here. So see you soon next time here on The World Beyond.
Thank you for this inspiring exchange. Together as Emotioneers, we have once again gained fascinating insights and expanded the boundaries of the known. To all our listeners out there, remember that the world is full of undiscovered possibilities. Go out and shape our future. Until next time on The World Beyond.
Mac One presents The World Beyond. Brought to you by Michael Mack and his Emotioneers of Tomorrow.